Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's start in Bangladesh today, in the capital city, Dhaka.
My name is Abdul Muqtadir. I run a company called Incepta Pharmaceuticals.
Incepta Pharmaceuticals has roughly 10,000 employees. The company manufactures dozens of pharmaceutical products. It also makes vaccines, shots for hepatitis B, flu, tetanus, and several others. Abdul Muqtadir wants to manufacture COVID vaccines. So he emailed executives at Johnson & Johnson, at Moderna, and others.
I was in contact with some of the companies, several emails, and then they say that, sorry, we can't do anything. And when I wrote to Moderna for supply, they responded. But when I wrote to them for manufacturing here in Bangladesh, they didn't respond. J&J and Novavax never responded.
To be clear, those companies didn't respond or said they couldn't help. Now, as you heard, he said Moderna did reply about selling COVID vaccine it had manufactured, but the company was silent when it came to Muqtadir's offer to make COVID vaccines in Bangladesh. He says he has three idle manufacturing lines that right now could be put to use.
If nobody is taking this support from us, so we are sitting actually on a potential supply place of almost like 1.2 billion doses.
Muqtadir acknowledges that the new COVID vaccines have new specific manufacturing processes. He acknowledges that Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and the like all have ironclad intellectual property rights over those vaccines as well. Also true, most of the doses currently coming off established production lines are going through prior agreement to the U.S., Europe, and a handful of other rich nations. That's produced a global vaccine divide, meaning parts of Asia, South America, and Africa may not be able to fully vaccinate against COVID until 2023, according to some estimates. Abdul Muqtadir, Incepta CEO, says the pharma giants should see the vaccine gap as an opportunity for them.
This is what the strategy should be. The people who have invented, everybody should come forward, join hands and support them so that they can actually multiply their production bases without compromising with the quality to as many different places as possible. And it is going to remain with them. It is their property. They are going to benefit from this. But the number is going to be so many billions that eventually they are going to be benefited most.
Let alone the additional billions of COVID vaccine doses that could go around the world. Abdul Muqtadir is chairman and managing director of Incepta Pharmaceuticals in Dhaka, Bangladesh. So today, we're going to talk about the legal, regulatory, and political realities that have produced a global COVID vaccination divide. Now, this is the system that produced a history-making series of vaccines in record time. That is a fact. But is this also the system that's preventing worldwide distribution of those vaccines to beat back this global pandemic? That's what we're going to explore. And we'll start today with Anne McDonald-Pritchett. She is Senior Vice President of Policy and Research at the industry group Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. Anne McDonald-Pritchett, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, how would you describe how the global vaccine rollout has been going so far?
Well, I would say that biopharmaceutical companies are solely focused on vaccinating as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, and that there's been an unprecedented level of collaboration among companies, governments, and non-government partners to develop, manufacture, and deliver vaccines to meet the global demand. I'd note that what's really incredible is that in addition to being able to produce vaccines within a year, is the fact that we're projected to have vaccine capacity around the globe reach 10 billion this year alone.
But then, as many experts have noted, most of that vaccine capacity is concentrated in a small handful of countries, though. The availability of those doses, is that a problem?
So I wouldn't say that's accurate. I would say that our entire industry is focused on bringing vaccines to patients around the globe. We have globally diverse supply chains. We are working with hundreds of suppliers and manufacturing partners around the globe. You know, it's a historic and a heroic effort to seek to administer billions of doses of vaccine around the globe. The stakes couldn't be higher, and we all recognize that. And that's why our companies are continuing to expand their collaborations to provide manufacturing facilities around the globe and increase manufacturing capacity. I would just note, if you look at Pfizer alone, they have more than 20 facilities in 11 different countries, and that's to support supplying vaccines to 165 different countries.
Mm.
And it's important to recognize, you know, there are tens of thousands of employees that have to be trained on specific aspects of each particular vaccine to ensure that they are handled, distributed in stores, and stored in ways that adhere to strict safety standards.
So according to some experts and analysis who've been tracking where the vaccines are going, there's been roughly 400 million vaccines delivered so far, but 90% of those are going to wealthy and middle-income countries. Is that not true?
I can't speak to what the specific doses are that are being delivered to each country, but I would say that our companies are partnering with a range of international partners and NGOs to accelerate the delivery of COVID-19 vaccines to countries around the world. You know, industry is working with WHO's COVAX facility, which is focused on global vaccine distribution, and they began rolling out 2 billion vaccine doses for low- and middle-income countries in February of this year. Companies are also working with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The Biden administration has committed $4 billion to COVAX, which again is the International Vaccine Alliance, working to distribute doses to low- and middle-income countries. So I wouldn't say that the distribution or getting vaccines to countries is the biggest challenge. I would say that the biggest challenge is in the last-mile distribution. There's a lot of work that needs to be done there. Kenya, for example, recently received over 1 million doses of AZ's vaccine, but only 40,000 Kenyans have been vaccinated. So we think the key focus should be on seeking to further expand collaborations so that we can provide vaccine sites at the heart of affected communities in the U.S. and around the globe. We think that's actually one of the biggest challenges. But again, I would note our companies are upgrading plants, looking to identify more global partners that are able to meet their technical capabilities so that we can support broad and equitable global access.
Okay. So your point about the last mile is well taken, and we're going to explore that a little bit later in the show. But there are several different organizations and global collaborations that are worthy of discussion. Because, for example, in May of last year, the WHO created a technology sharing pool specifically designed to help countries make coronavirus vaccines, right? And that pool is called the COVID-19 Technology Access Pool. That was May of last year. And it's interesting to note that several months later, in October, Moderna publicly pledged, this is October of last year, not to enforce its COVID-19 related patents. However, as of now, as of this year, that same COVID-19 technology access pool, where companies like Moderna could share their technology for even greater distribution, that has attracted zero contributions. There's no participation in this global access pool run by the WHO. Can you explain to me why?
Well, I think what's really at the heart of this is that manufacturers are continuing to evolve the standards for production of vaccines in collaboration with regulators, and that the extremely widespread collaboration between manufacturers, contract manufacturers, and suppliers has allowed us to speed production capacity while maintaining quality standards to meet global needs. I would say for some of these vaccines, they're using new technology platforms that, while they provide a lot of benefits, they do pose considerable challenges. and they require specific, particular technical capabilities of facilities, and that we want to ensure that we are partnering with companies all over the world, suppliers and contract manufacturers and other innovative companies that are going to be able to meet those specific needs. As you know, with vaccines, ensuring quality control throughout the manufacturing process is perhaps one of the most critical elements. And we feel that the unprecedented level of collaboration among and between companies, including companies that generally are competing with each other, has really been unprecedented. And that is ensuring that we're able to meet the global needs without having to explore other alternatives at this point.
Yeah, your point about the technological needs, the quality control around the production of COVID vaccines is well taken. That applies to all pharmaceutical production. I think we can agree to that. But, I mean, are you saying that there isn't confidence that places like Incepta in Dhaka could meet those quality assurances? I mean, they're manufacturing vaccines that are other vaccines that are going into people's arms right now.
So I can't speak to the specifics of that company and their manufacturing capabilities, but I would say that only vaccine manufacturers are in a position to assess the specific technical capabilities of potential partners. I would note that with the recently announced J&J and Merck partnership, that it was clear that J&J had looked around the world to identify companies and contract manufacturing to meet their specific need, and that at the end of the day, they were only able to identify a handful, more than 10 at this point, that were able to meet their specific needs. Now, what I would say is that our companies are learning as they go. As you've seen with Pfizer and other companies, they've created more efficiencies in the manufacturing process. They've developed new tools for ensuring quality. And I think that over time, you're going to see more and more partnerships as we're able to develop those best practices will facilitate partnerships with others.
So Anne McDonald-Pritchett with Pharma, stand by here for a second. We're talking about the global COVID vaccine divide and why it seems that some countries, especially in South America, Africa, and Asia, may not be able to get fully vaccinated against COVID until around 2023. It's interesting. Albert Kourla, the Pfizer CEO, said last year when it came to sharing technology, he thought the idea was nonsense and dangerous. We'll talk about why when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking about the international system that both gave rise to history-making COVID vaccines and also that same system which may be hampering the equitable global distribution of those vaccines. I'm joined today by Anne McDonald-Pritchett. She's Senior Vice President of Policy and Research at the industry group Pharma. And let's listen to a moment to what the WHO thinks right now about the fact that the vast majority of doses have gone to just a handful of richer nations. Here's WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus expressing concern.
The gap between the number of vaccines administered in rich countries and the number of vaccines administered through COVAX is growing every single day and becoming more grotesque every day. the world's poorest countries wonder whether rich countries really mean what they say when they talk about solidarity. The inequitable distribution of vaccines is not just a moral outrage. It's also economically and epidemiologically self-defeating.
Well, joining us now is Madhavi Sundar, a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, associate dean for international and graduate programs, and author of From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice. Professor Sundar, welcome.
Hi, Meghna. It's great to be here with you today.
So first of all, let's just check something. Is it true or not that the most of the COVID vaccine doses manufactured thus far have been going to a small number of rich and middle-income countries?
That is absolutely correct. So far, out of about 400 million vaccines that have been delivered around the world, 90% of them have gone to rich countries. They've bought up countries like the United States and Canada have bought up enough supply, not just for their population, but for their population many times over.
So we're going to talk about those agreements that are a major part of this picture in just a second. But you heard Anne McDonald-Pritchett a little earlier say that the manufacturing capacity is continuing to grow around the world, and that perhaps that gap will be sort of naturally closed in an acceptable amount of time.
Yeah, she was talking about how the drug manufacturing companies here of these major vaccines are seeking their own licensing partners. But what really is so concerning is that she mentioned, you know what, over time, they will find more partners that they find acceptable. We don't have time, Meghna. Right now, we see variants developing and spreading quickly around the world. These variants may, the vaccines that have already been delivered in countries like the United States, they may be resistant to those variants. So this is a race that we're in to really finally end this pandemic. And the serious concern here is that the great success that countries like the U.S. have had so far, I mean, President Biden has given us great news. We're going to have the adults, all adults in America, potentially vaccinated by the end of May. But that success could be terribly undermined if the rest of the globe is not also vaccinated and so that we can stop the spread of those variants.
Mm. You know, the manufacturing capacity and quality assurance is something that we could explore quite a bit. However, let's just cut to the chase, right? Like, I think that Albert Kourla, the Pfizer CEO last year, when he first responded to the WHO's idea to create a technology sharing pool for COVID vaccines, I think his first response tells us what a big part of this debate is about. Because Kourla said at that time, I think it's nonsense and dangerous, he said. He said companies are investing billions to find a solution. Keep in mind if you have a discovery. And then he was concerned about international cooperation or cooperative groups that would, quote, take away your intellectual property. He said, I think that is dangerous. Is that the heart of this challenge right now?
Well, let me take it back to something you said at the start, Meghna. You said that this is a case where we've got companies that have ironclad IP rights, and they're being asked to waive some of those rights. Or it's also a case where it was exactly those IP rights, specifically patents, that led to the development of these vaccines at breakneck speed. I want to call BS on that, because basically the fact is, in this particular case, you know, in general, when we're talking about breakthrough medications, pharmaceutical companies are the poster child for patents. We give them a 20-year exclusive right to make, use and sell this invention because they've created breakthrough technology that saves lives. But in the case of COVID-19 vaccines, it was the U.S. government and other governments, including the German government, that invested the billions that were critical to the breakneck speed development of these vaccines. So Operation Warp Speed and government grants from NIH-funded research to, in the case of Moderna, just about 100% of the cost of the development, manufacture, and distribution of the Moderna vaccine was paid for by the U.S. government. That's U.S. taxpayers.
So I would like to jump in at this point to kind of correct the record, because our companies have been investing for decades in infectious disease space and in various technologies that are what enabled us to make the progress against COVID. And that regarding IP, the WTO looked at a waiver back in October, and they didn't move forward on it because it was recognized that IP wasn't a barrier and that such a measure would be counterproductive. And Japan, Brazil, and other countries agreed at that point. I think it's important to recognize that every player in the biopharmaceutical industry, as soon as we started recognizing the magnitude of this crisis, began seeking to look at their compound libraries, invest in new development, and to ramp up manufacturing at risk at the same time, because we recognized we needed as many shots on goal as possible in order to make progress against this crisis. I can't speak to Albert Bourla's specific comments last year, but I would say the fact that Pfizer has 20 facilities in 11 different countries and is going to support supplying vaccines to 165 different countries speaks to the commitment of our industry. And as I indicated at the outset, a number of our companies are partnering with global partners, including the Serum Institute of India, to support manufacturing, procurement, and distribution to address low- and middle-income country needs. I think it's really telling that the fact that international capacity across manufacturing is expected to allow us to provide 10 billion vaccines around the globe by the end of this year. That is nothing short of heroic and remarkable.
I think it's
unfortunate that there are kind of spurious attacks on IP being a barrier when, you know, companies and all of our partners are literally working around the clock and around the globe so that we can meet global needs.
Professor Sunder, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, partnership is the key here. So the fact is we cannot ignore the reality that the U.S. government and taxpayer money funded billions of dollars underlying the COVID-19 vaccine development. Under U.S. law, that would give the U.S. government rights to help step in and reduce prices in order to promote access, especially when it comes to meeting the needs of a global public health crisis. The key issue here is that these were not just the result of private investment, but they are also very importantly and significantly the result of government investment. And in fact, many people call these vaccines the people's vaccine for that reason. And it's critical that not just does the U.S. government here in particular, the Biden administration, have the legal authority to step in and dictate lower prices and broader access, more licensing of this technology. But obviously here we have a real critical need to do so.
Okay, so but Moncef Slaoui, who was the chief scientific advisor for Operation Warp Speed, which, yes, I mean, it was an $18 billion taxpayer-funded effort to get a COVID vaccine created. He recently said, I mean, the New York Times just a couple of days reported that Western health officials say they never intended to exclude other countries. Patent sharing, they said, simply never came up. And Slaoui said, quote, it was U.S.-centric. It wasn't anti-global. Everyone was in agreement that vaccine doses, once the U.S. is served, will go elsewhere. Professor Sunder, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, so I think there's been a couple different confusing angles in the debate so far. Yeah. A lot of people have been talking about vaccine diplomacy, countries like Russia and China giving their vaccines away in the developing world, whereas the United States, it was argued, is taking this kind of vaccine nationalist approach. We take care of ourselves. And some of what Biden was originally saying sounded like that. But really, the fight over IP rights isn't about the United States buying doses and giving them to other parts of the world, and particularly the developing world. This is about asking the drug manufacturers to stand back, stay out of the way, give a green light to companies like Incepta in Bangladesh and well-known pharmaceutical companies in India, for example, that have for decades now been bringing safe, effective, and affordable generic medicines to, in particular, to the developing world. India is called the pharmacy to the developing world. So we again, really need to be focusing on the waiver of patent rights here so that companies aren't going to stand in the way of other drug manufacturers like Incepta that say, we're ready. If you can share this technology with us, we can begin producing hundreds of millions of doses. And in fact, I think the gentleman, Mr. Mukhtadir from Incepta said 1.2 billion doses.
Over a couple of years.
So I would say it's impossible to assess whether Incepta would be able to meet the specific capabilities that are needed to produce these vaccines. As I mentioned, quality control issues are paramount. The last thing we would want would be for IP to be given away to a company that doesn't have the technical expertise, the quality control measures in place, the ability to retool their facilities to meet the needs and to be able to meet regulatory requirements. If we have a vaccine that's produced elsewhere that isn't safe or effective, that could dramatically set back all of our collective efforts. I think this is a time when our industry has demonstrated more than ever its willingness to work with willing partners who have the technical capabilities and can meet our particular needs. And that's why you've seen competitors working with each other. That's why you've seen partnerships around the globe. So I think we need to focus on how we can collectively continue to work together to advance vaccine access and ensure that we're able to address those last mile distribution issues and IP simply is not the barrier here.
But Anne McDonald Pritchett, let me just say, you said IP being given away to manufacturers that that you'd be concerned couldn't achieve the quality standards necessary. No one is saying that the IP would be given away. I mean, this is why actually Mukhtadir was a really good example at the start. I mean, he's actually turning around as a smaller Asian manufacturer, South Asian manufacturer, and looking at Moderna, looking at Pfizer, et cetera, and saying, we can help you expand your market. We can accelerate your reach into South Asia, into Asia, into Africa. It's not a giving away of the IP. It's, in fact, a growth, a radical growth of the reach of the COVID vaccine, which therefore he said would translate to billions of dollars more for this company. So where's the giving away?
Well, so again, our other guest was proposing that there should be a margin and seizing of IP and that it should be given away. I would say just giving someone the patents isn't giving them, you know, the full recipe, so to speak. It is important that, you know, it's vaccine facilities aren't widgets. You need specialized facilities to meet the needs of particular vaccines. And that's why we have multiple companies with multiple vaccines that have their own supply networks around the globe, because we have to make sure that they're meeting the specific needs of that vaccine. And as you know, we have some vaccines that are using new technologies of which they have specialized technical requirements. And just for companies that have expertise in this area, it takes time for them to retool facilities if they want to expand their manufacturing. So it's really critical that we're ensuring that any manufacturers and other suppliers that we're partnering with have the technical capabilities, can meet the quality control standards, can access the raw materials, and fill the particular identified gap. Remember that our companies have global manufacturing networks, and so we have facilities, for example, and partners in India and other countries. And so companies need to be making decisions that make sense for their particular vaccine and what their distribution plans
are. All right. Professor Sundar, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think, Magna, you mentioned it earlier. The WHO created this COVID technology sharing pool, access pool. And it just speaks volumes that no pharmaceutical company has stepped in to share their knowledge. I mean, absolutely, building the capacity around the world of more generic drug manufacturers to be able to make safe and affordable vaccines is critically important to fighting this pandemic and future pandemics. But where are the pharmaceutical companies? Why aren't they working in partnership with the World Health Organization to begin to transfer this critical technology. The idea that we just have to, the whole world has to just sit back and wait for them to do it on their time with the partners they choose, when many more, not just are the partners available and ready and able like Incepta, but the World Health Organization has pledged experts. They are standing at the ready to help in this process, this critical process of technology transfer. It's correct. Just publishing the patent and giving the recipe isn't enough. We need to really be sharing the knowledge and building capacity around the world with these various manufacturers. But we need to do it now, because it will take several months, perhaps, to retool those factories and get them up and running to be able to produce in the hundreds of millions that we need.
We have a minute left to go, and Anne McDonald, yeah. Pritchett, I know I need to let you go, so go ahead and have a last thought here.
So I just might note that we are partnering with WHO, and that's why the COVAX facility for global vaccine distribution is set to roll out 2 billion doses for low and middle income starting in February of this year. And that we agree there is a need to expand and address some of our capacity gaps over the longer term. And we're committed to working with countries and NGOs and others around the world to address some of those capacity issues. But again, I think it's important to recognize that in less than a year, we have a range of vaccines that are safe and effective. There are manufacturers around the globe that are continuing to develop new vaccines, and that we are all collectively working on ensuring that we support equitable access around the world. You know, we this is a war, and we need to be successful, and our industry is fully committed to doing everything it can to meet global demand.
Well, Anne McDonald Pritchett, Senior Vice President of Policy and Research at the industry group Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're going to talk more about the government's role, governments, plural, in closing this vaccine divide, or also having created it, when we come back. We're getting feedback here on Facebook. Ray Russell says, it's the administration's responsibility to serve its citizens first. As we get excess vaccines, offer then to other countries. This should not be an issue. Hop on social media, on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio, and send us your thoughts. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're exploring how the same international intellectual property system that helped give rise to the fastest vaccine development in human history, those development of those COVID vaccines, a true accomplishment, may also be the same system that is hobbling the ability or even the desire to quickly get doses into arms around the world. Essentially, there is now a COVID vaccine divide between richer countries and poorer countries on planet Earth. Here's Mustakeem Degama, counselor at the South African Permanent Mission to the World Trade Organization. He was behind a proposal co-sponsored by India and South Africa that calls on the WTO to waive IP rights for COVID-19 vaccines.
We have seen the interconnectedness of the world, and certainly COVID-19 has brought this to a fore. This proposal essentially proposes that we waive certain forms of intellectual property rights to ensure an increase of production. And we've seen large-scale shortages of vaccines, not because of any other reason, but because of the inappropriate use of intellectual property rights.
Now, a big part of this story is the fact that many of those richer governments, especially the United States, by virtue of having helped pay for the development of the vaccine, paid for also the right to buy a lot of doses right off the bat. So earlier this month at a press conference, here's what President Biden said when he was asked what the U.S. would do with surplus vaccine.
If we have a surplus, we're going to share it with the rest of the world. We've already decided we're going to work with the outfit COVAX. We've committed $4 billion to help get the funding for more vaccines around the world. This is not something that can be stopped by a fence, no matter how high you build a fence or a wall. So we're not going to be ultimately safe until the world is safe. And so we're going to start off making sure Americans are taken care of first, but we're then going to try to help the rest of the world. Thank you.
Well, we're joined today by Madhavi Sundar, a professor of law at Georgetown University. Her work focuses on intellectual property law and law and culture, author of From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice. And joining us now as well is Rachel Silverman, policy fellow at the Center for Global Development. She leads policy-oriented research on global health financing and incentive structures. Rachel Silverman, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So let me just first ask for your take on this, that essentially part of the problem we're seeing right now is entirely predictable because by partnering with drug companies to help develop these COVID vaccines, I mean, the United States in particular legitimately bought its way to the front of the line. And this is why you hear President Biden saying, you know, if we have surplus, then we'll think about global distribution.
Yeah, it's not surprising that this is the case. I mean, we, as you say, and as the advocates for sharing IP say, the U.S. government, European governments invested quite a bit of money up front in research and development for these vaccines. And they spent quite a bit of money to stand up these supply chains at risk. And it is understandable, both because they invested this money up front and also because there is a domestic political imperative to serve their populations first and prioritize their own populations, that they are trying to get as much vaccine for their populations as quickly as they can and then worrying about the world. But that doesn't mean it's not leading to major and unacceptable inequities.
But again, so I think there's multiple layers to why these predictable inequities exist, right? I mean, I think one of the points that Professor Sundar was trying to make is, as far as I can understand, in terms of the agreements reached by these governments and the pharmaceutical companies, there wasn't really explicit language in any of the contracts that would have guaranteed doses for lower income countries. Or was there any language that would have created a different structure to incentivize companies to share, again, this new knowledge and essentially loosen their grip on the patents they would subsequently control?
Well, for Moderna participated in something called CEPI, which does have some access provisions in it, although they're not entirely transparent about what they are or what they mean. But the problem is that we're not in a traditional IP paradigm where IP is the one thing preventing companies like the company you interviewed earlier in Bangladesh from producing these vaccines. And notably, Moderna has said it will waive all, for the duration of the pandemic, they will waive their patent protections around their intellectual property for the vaccine production. But that's not enough to actually produce the vaccine. So the gentleman you interviewed in Bangladesh, he's not able to do that much with that. I think the way to think about it is almost like you go to a Michelin-starred restaurant and you get a dish and it's a masterpiece. It's a triumph of molecular gastronomy. Just because somebody says, we won't sue you if you make this dish, does not mean you suddenly know how to make this dish. Now, if they publish the recipe, you can attempt to make the dish. And if you are yourself a Michelin-starred chef, you can, with enough time, maybe produce something that's quite similar. But if you want to produce the exact same dish in the exact same way, you really need the original chef's help showing you, walking you through exactly what he or she did to produce the exact same thing. So that's more the situation we're in, where the saying, we won't sue you, is not really enough to go out and then make these vaccines.
Right. So just to carry your analogy here a little further, the problem is the original chefs are not willing to help. I mean, I think Moderna is a really good example because, you know, to put it roughly, Moderna provided the delivery technology, right, for its COVID vaccine, but the sort of the biochemical innovation actually comes from the CDC. The CDC gives Moderna that new piece of technology. They wed it with how they can deliver it into human bodies, and you get Moderna's version of the vaccine. But again, I mean, you said, yes, Moderna last year did pledge not to enforce its COVID-19-related patents. But as I mentioned earlier in the show, and here's where the original chef isn't helping you analogy comes in, they're not participating in the WHO's own organizations or own collaboration for technology sharing. So what good is their promise if they won't participate in the international structures that have been set up for technology transfer for these particular vaccines?
Sure. Well, I think what we're seeing is two things. So one thing we're seeing is that patent waivers by themselves don't do that much. You really need this active, cooperative knowledge sharing. So the patent waiver by itself, it's a nice symbolic gesture, but it doesn't really get you very far in terms of the practical challenge of making more vaccine. But the other thing we're seeing is, you know, pharma is to some extent willing to share its technology, but it is willing to do that within the context of a bilateral licensing or contract deal, where it is in control, where it can actually go in, set up the facilities, do what's called the technology transfer, where they help the other companies set up their production line. There are concerns about quality control there and making sure everything's up to standard. But it's also, it is an IP issue and a trade secret issue to some degree. In the context of a bilateral deal, if they go give all of their technology, it's not necessarily going to be disseminated further without their permission. If they post it all on the internet or as part of CTAP, the share WHO's sharing agreement, then they'd lose control over it, right? It's not just with their designated partners who they've vetted, who they think, okay, we will not have quality control issues and we'll even get royalties. It's with the entire world.
Right. Okay, so I hear that. So here's what I'd like to do with both of you in the last 8 minutes of the show. I mean, I find that as with every topic, it's very easy to sort of fall into a very binary black or white conversation. Like it's either this or this. But certainly the true solutions fall somewhere in the middle. So let's focus on that solution space for a little bit. Professor Sunder, I mean, as simply as you can put it for all of us to grasp, like what would you change right now? Or what would you do to expand production and access to COVID vaccines? What needs to change fundamentally with the IP system as we have it?
Yeah, I think that people still don't really understand the role that patents are playing in limiting the supply here. And so people are still thinking there's surplus in the United States, let's donate the surplus. Or, you know, we have wonderful organizations like COVAX that have, you know, donated two billion vaccines for around the world. But it's just that we need billions more and we need them quickly. And I think the critical thing that has to happen now is that the Biden administration has to basically say, we're going to waive patents for the duration of this pandemic. Let's end this in 2021. Let's force these companies that the U.S. government has helped to finance with respect to the vaccines, let's force them to share the technology, not just the recipe, but to really get in there and be active participants in building the capacity of global manufacturers that are ready and just need this technology sharing and tech transfer to happen. So that's, I think, absolutely crucial that the Biden administration has to stand up and say, you are not just going to have to give your recipe, but you're going to have to share the technology. It's all hands on deck now. Let's get the globe vaccinated.
Can I just jump in here, though? I mean, that is a massive exercise of government power you're talking about. I mean, would that not have any future chilling effects on companies' desire to develop new technology if they think, well, the U.S. government's going to come in and just bust open our patents?
Well, here's the thing, though, Meghna. This is an outlier situation, not just because it's a global pandemic, which frankly alone should be enough. But here, it was an outlier in the sense that in cases like Moderna, for example, the U.S. is just about 100% the supplier of the funds that went to the development of these vaccines. So we have enormous leverage here, much more than in other kinds of cases. So I don't think that this is going to set a precedent or interfere with incentives and the role that the important role that patents play in other kinds of development. It could be limited in time, like I said, to just really get us on the road to building that capacity. And fundamentally, this isn't about handouts and donations of excess supply. This is about countries saying, we want to help ourselves. We want to be able to make these vaccines in Bangladesh, in South Africa, in India. Plus, just don't stand in our way. Give us not just the recipe, the technical know-how, and we'll run with it to vaccinate our populations and the populations of our neighboring countries. So, and the idea that the United States would stand in its way, or that the Biden administration wouldn't, forcefully facilitate this technology transfer, it doesn't make sense in this context.
Rachel Silverman, what do you think of the idea of that Professor Sundar is putting forth? Would you go so far, or is there a solution set that pulls short of the United States essentially blowing open the patents, right, for now, for a limited time, on some of these vaccines?
So I wouldn't necessarily frame it as going so far, because I do think some of industry's concerns about the dynamic effects of on innovation are overstated. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I think blowing open patents goes too far necessarily. It's more just that I don't think, practically speaking, it's likely to be the best way forward to increase supply. So what we have overall is a supply problem, right? We have pharma companies which are trying to scale up, but I think maybe lack some of the urgency that we would like to be seeing in doing that, and seem to be thinking, okay, it's okay that we get to the developing world eventually. And that's not okay. It needs to happen now. And so we need to create the conditions for pharma to feel the same urgency that they feel about vaccinating the United States or the UK or Europe about vaccinating the entirety of the world. And so what does that mean? Well, part of it means helping them in some ways. So again, earlier on the program, you had a guest from Bangladesh saying he was offering his facility and he was hearing back crickets from pharma.
Yeah.
So that needs to change. There needs to be, now maybe it's that pharma's overwhelmed. Maybe it's that they only have so many people who can go out and make these deals and vet facilities. So they need to be explicit. What is the problem in getting back to these potential companies that could help? How could the US government or others help facilitate it? Maybe they can vet the facility. Maybe they can do some of the due diligence groundwork. Maybe they can invest the money to help upgrade the supply chain, the supply lines in the way that would need to happen. And that's already happening in some cases. So I think it's less that busting open patents goes too far, and more that we need their active cooperation in this tech transfer, and we need them to feel urgency around doing it.
Well,
can the U.S. government?
You're probably getting to what I was just going to ask, but we're running down of time so quickly. Then, I mean, how could the U.S. government incentivize that cooperation?
So I think it's a mix of carrots and sticks. So carrots are, again, making it easier for pharma to do this. So helping set up these deals, helping bring the pieces into place, doing some of this due diligence, maybe subsidizing and lubricating the deals with investments for facilities in low and middle income countries. And we have U.S. government bodies that have the mandate to do that, the Development Finance Corporation. But it could also mean sticks. It could also mean saying, if you don't do this, we will take retaliatory action. That could be march-in rights, as the previous guests have talked about. That could be suing for patent infringement, because the U.S. government's about to own a slice of the Moderna patent itself. Yeah. It could be just putting pressure on pharma more generally around the regulatory regime and saying, we really want you to do this. We can make your life quite difficult if you don't.
Okay, that would imply that the U.S. government and lawmakers have the backbone to stand up to industry groups like pharma, which are pouring millions of dollars into their campaign coffers. But Professor Sundar, look, we have 45 seconds left, and I just want to give you a last thought. Do you see possibilities in what Rachel Silverman is saying, or do you think it's time for more sort of decisive action?
No, I think the fact that the sticks exist means that there are possibilities. I just think that ordinary people need to know, and this show is so important, that this isn't that we can address the issue of supply. We can actually vaccinate the world this year if we cooperate. And the Biden administration really should be leading that dialogue on global cooperation to end this global pandemic.
Well, Madhavi Sundar is a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. Her work focuses on intellectual property law and culture, also associate dean there for international and graduate programs, author of From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice. Professor Sundar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Meghna. It was so great to be here with you.
And Rachel Silverman, policy fellow at the Center for Global Development, leading policy-oriented research on global health financing and incentive structures. Rachel Silverman, it was great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.